Okay, so the next talk will be by Agustin Sabio Vera on the Regi limit of gauge theories and gravity with links to integrability.
Okay, you can hear me now? Okay. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for the kind invitation to come to Zurich. It's always nice to be here. I was asked to give an introduction to an old subject, which is the Regi limit of gauge theories. In particular, I will discuss the Regi limit in QCD and in gravity, and the target of my talk will be to. Okay. First of all, yes. I realize that this is a very nice poster, and I liked it a lot. And I noticed that for each of the pieces in this knife, you have a representation of something. You see, here, everywhere. And then I realized there is something lacking here. Therefore, my main task is to relate this to a Pomeron exchange. Okay? So if anything, just keep this slide in your head and that will be enough. Okay? After this important statement, my talk is going to be divided into four parts. A brief introduction where I will just skip all technicalities and I will try to focus on the physical picture of why this limit is interesting, and some smart people have been doing it for so many years. Okay, so it will be very sketchy and maybe a cartoon of the physics here. Okay, then I will go for a game which I've been playing for some time, which is fun for me, although I don't know if I have a very interesting result, but I will show you where I am there in this matrix, BFK as a matrix random walk and connections to this SL2 spin chain. Let's see. Then I will go into gravity, although I will continue explaining the basics of how to construct pieces of this BFK equation. So in this third part, I will discuss how to construct what is called the BFK kernel, both in QCD, which is very well known now from the 70s, but also in gravity. I will try to connect it to gravity, and I will show you which are the universal features there. And okay, I think it's a kind of introductory discussion. And then I will go on, in my opinion, quite important result that we put on the web on Friday on how to use techniques in the Regi limit in order to analyze graviton scattering 4-point amplitudes for any supergravity, okay? And then we see some nice features that still have to be understood, but I think it's interesting because we have results in the gravitational coupling to all orders. It tells us how the amplitudes behave at very large energies, okay? So I'll start with the cartoon. Everything starts realizing that hadron-hadron collisions grow with energy, and this is known for many years ago. Still true in 2011 with the latest LHC data. And one can argue many things about all what I'm going to say, but one possibility is this is compatible. The total cross-section for hadron-hadron collisions is compatible with the growth, power-like growth of S to the 0.1, roughly speaking. If you think about it, you try to give an interpretation to this in terms of pure unitarity, analyticity, and crossing of scattering amplitudes, it's possible in the context of Regi theory. All you have to assume is you have to go to the complex angular momentum plane and then assume that the poles dominate your amplitudes. If you do that, then you can see that your amplitude factorizes in terms of some vertices which depends, I never see this, okay, some vertices which depend on T, the momentum transfer, and then you have some S to some function, which is a function of the momentum transfer only. In general, for the cross-axis to growth, this has to be something, some exchange in the T-channel which has the quantum numbers of the vacuum, and this is what generally is called the Pomeron. As in this case, we have a scattering of two very large objects, and they are not perturbative, we are going to call this soft Pomeron exchange, okay, so no perturbative origin. And just keep in mind that this is a power like to the point one. Now, this is pre-QCD. Now, can we have a picture of this power like growth once we know that QCD is the right theory for strong interactions? And then there was an attempt in the 70s in St. Petersburg, with connections to Novosibirsk, to understand this. And then in order to be able to calculate this perturbatively, you need some hard scaling your problem. And when you have hadron-hadron scattering, for the total cross-section, that is difficult to get, but if you fix some properties of the final state, you can get, I will explain this better, you can get some hard scale, which I call Q-square, and in order to get your power-like behavior, you're going to go to the limit, or central mass energy is much larger than the momentum transfer, which is called the Regi limit, and this hard scale needs to be larger than lambda QCD, and this allows you for a perturbative expansion, so you're going to get a small coupling, so you will be able to calculate something. And then what you're going to get are terms of the order as alpha s at the large, alpha s times log of energy, and then these terms are for order one, and then you realize that you have to really sum them to all orders, okay, in order to get an accurate description of the scattering. What we had before, which how to calculate this resummation is the key points of the BFKL resummation. You do the following. Your cross-section is going to be the sum of squares of many inelastic amplitudes by the optical theorem, and then the way to get these logarithms is to say that the invariant mass, you're going to take the Regi limit in each sub-amplitude here, in each subsystem. So you're going to say that S is much larger than the invariant mass between the particles 1 and 2, 2, 3, and so on. Okay? And these invariant masses have to be bigger than the momentum transfer in each of these tube channels. This is enough in order to pick up the leading behavior of alpha times log S. You also assume in your calculation is that the KT of your emitted particles doesn't change too much from the Q square that you have as an external scale. And the essential key point of the resummation is that since by this limit you have decoupled longitudinal degrees of freedom from transverse degrees of freedom in your four momenta, okay, by the limit. Therefore, as I will explain later, all the dynamics is going to be on this transverse plane, and in the longitudinal plane is where you are going to get the resummation, because the phase space for emitted soft particles, this particle 1 is going to be emitted with a rapidity y1, 2 with y2, and so on. If I impose this ordering, this limit is equivalent to imposing an ordering in rapidities of the emitted particles. So the rapidity of y1 is bigger than this one and this one. If I impose this in this form, and I have a power in alpha for each integration, you get not only alpha s times y, which is log of s to the n, but also crucial for convergence and n factorial. Okay, this is the key of the whole calculation. And then you will have to attach a coefficient which carries all the information about the transverse degrees of freedom. That coefficient is essentially what is the BFKL kernel. Okay, so just by the limit we have decoupled rapidities from transverse momenta. This is what is called the leading order approximation, where you have the same power in alpha s as log of s. Let me go and refine this picture in a much more complicated calculation, but all you do is the following. You keep having the Regi limit, the multi-Regi limit, and then you have what is called the quasi-multi-Regi limit, which is very simple. You do the same as before, but you want to lose one power in the log of energy. So you allow just one pair of particles to be nearby in rapidity. Okay? So you are not having an strong ordering for those two, so you lose a power in the lock of energy. You lose one power in the rapidity. Okay? Once you put all the next to in-order corrections, the problem becomes much more physical, because a leading order, the whole problem is scale invariant. A leading order diagrams which contribute to the run-order coupling go away. And essentially, whatever you put in the lock of energy here, a leading order is independent of whatever you scale here in this lock. But a next to leading order, you are sensitive to it. Because, for example, let me do the following exercise. Let me change S0 by S0 prime, okay, by this parameter B. So I have a Y prime plus B in the total integration. I do the same exercise as before, and you can check that you get a term, which is the same term as before, alpha S Y to the same power, is the leading order part, and then you will get a next to leading order part, which is alpha S to the N, and you lose one power in the lock of energy. And this is the next to leading order approximation. So the next to leading order introduces all the scales in the problem. Also, next to leading order, you are sensitive to running of the coupling. And it's crucial, if you want to do, for example, any phenomenology, to go to next to leading order. However, if you calculate, you can perform the same calculations in N equal 4 supermills, and in N equal 4 supermills, the leading order approximation is the same for both theories, QCD and N equal 4, because it's only sensitive to gluons. There is no running coupling, so no fermions. But at next to leading order, both theories are different. Okay. I will explain later, but okay. Anyway, that's the message. Yes. Yes. We are computing a total cross section.
Yeah, so that's why we integrate, right?
Yes.
So why does this regime dominate? Because then so we integrate in principle over everything, right? And then suddenly there is a region of integration that dominates, right? Which is the multi-regi limit.
No, you impose. I don't know if I understand your question, but anyway, this is enough to get leading logarithms and sub-leading logarithms. That's all. I will tell you now that with this you describe the total cross section, okay, absorptive part, but also elastic scattering, and you will get the same picture in elastic scattering as in inelastic scattering. You will have the same effective vertices. Okay.
So what quantity are we computing? It's scattering of two gluons into what? Into anything or into n gluons?
In this case, it's two gluons into two plus n gluons. Okay.
Right, but with fixed external momenta, or we integrate over them? Because I see integrals.
You integrate over the phase space of the emitted ones. Okay, you have some fixed
over all the phase space, or only a particular one?
Over the phase space, but under this limit.
But why do I fix a limit? Either I integrate over everything, or I fix the external ones. These, I would imagine, are the two natural choices.
It's the momenta of the incoming gluons. Okay,
yes.
This fixes your center of mass energy.
And then I integrate over the other ones.
And then you have to integrate over the phase space of the emitted ones, but under certain assumptions, which are going to give you the logarithmic contributions. If you integrate over the full phase space, then it's a full calculation. It's very complicated.
So this dominates the full
This dominates the limit where S is much bigger than T. But this is the essential feature of resummations. You have to make some simplification of your Feynman rules. Okay, and here the simplification is the decoupling between longitudinal and transverse.
So the only assumption is that S is much bigger than T, and automatically this implies that the multi-regi is what dominates the integral.
No, you have to impose also the multi-regi.
But the multi-regi, I thought it was not up to me. I have to integrate over the Ys, right? I fix S and T.
You have an extra condition, which is to impose the strong ordering in the rapidity of the emitted particles. Otherwise, it's too complicated. And then you have to relax that condition in your approximation. A leading order, you have a strong ordering in all the emitted particles, okay? And this is enough to get the leading logarithms. And then to get the sub-leading logarithms, one power less than in the coupling, then you allow two of them to be nearby in rapidity, which essentially means that the matrix element of these two particles is treated exactly when you do the integration. That's why when you go to next to linear, it's more complicated.
Okay.
Because the integration is exact for two of the emitted particles. Okay? Anyway, good question. Okay, now, Yes. Now we are with all this calculation, and I was telling you that we need a hard scale to justify the perturbative calculation. Okay? How to get the hard scale in an experiment? Okay? This hard scale, for example, could be that you have two incoming hadrons, and you extract some jet with a large PT, which I call Q squared, so you recognize the same hard scale as before, and another jet forward with the other hadron, with also a similar PT. Okay, and there, if these PTs are similar and large, then this justifies the approximations you are doing in your calculation, and then what you will have is a BFK ladder with emission of what is called mini jets, which are jets with strongly ordered in rapidity and with a similar PT. This is your amplitude, and to calculate the cross-section for this process, you will have to sum over all of this and then of the square of all of this. You could also have this process. In this process, you would also sum over the square of all of this, okay? But this process is different to this one. Why? Because this one, although the elements of the calculation are the same elements as before, this one doesn't produce a high multiplicity in your final state, but it produces what is called a rapidity gap. Because this is projected on a color singlet to have a Pomeron, and it doesn't allow any radiation here. So the characteristic in your, when you look at the experiment, is that you have all the remnant from the hadron, some jet, another jet, and in the middle nothing. This is, although the calculation is the same, okay, because the building blocks are the same, the final state that you produce is different to this one because this one populates all the regions in the detector. Now, all of this was known in the 70s, but then because of HERA physics, there was a huge interest in all of this because this was predicting growth with energy of cross-sections, and what you were measuring in deep inner scattering at the small x, at high energies, you were measuring that the structure functions were growing very rapidly. So there was suddenly a lot of interest in applying these techniques into the DIS context, okay? In DIS, the relevant, so you are proving with a lepton the structure of a hadron. You have the dominant diagram is this one with a virtual photon, a quark antiquark, and then the interaction with a certain gluon, which has a certain longitudinal momentum fraction of the original hadron. Okay, so the main two variables in DIS are this X, which is Q squared over S. So many times high energy is equivalent to a small x physics. Okay, you will see it's written in both ways, and the virtuality of your photon. The virtuality is important because 1 over Q squared tells you what are the distances that you are proving. Let's see, the distances you are proving inside this hadron, 1 over Q squared. So the larger Q squared, the smaller, if you wish. It's also related to leading twist contributions. If you make the Q squared bigger, 1 over Q squared becomes larger, and you are sensitive to larger distances inside the hadron. Okay? So, now, DIS is very interesting because allows you, because of this feature, that you are proving certain distances in your hadron, it allows you to go from a very perturbative physics, when Q squared is very large, so you resolve very small distances, it's a leading twist feature. If you, essentially just by changing the angle, the measured angle in this lepton, you can also decrease Q squared, so you make your virtual photon closer to real, and then you are sensitive to larger distances. So your cross-section should be different when you are a large Q squared or low Q squared. And this is essentially what we see also in the calculation, because when you do the perturbative calculation, we see that these cross-sections grow like essentially S to the 0.3. S to the 0.3 is not S to the 0.1 as we were seeing before for hadron-hadron. What is happening? What is happening is that we have calculated something perturbative, which is called hard BFK Pomeron or perturbative Pomeron. But if you go now to DIS experiments, again, all of this is a cartoon, eh? You go to DIS experiments, and then you look for your cross-section, your structure function, how it behaves as a function of the energy, okay? Now, and this plot, this is experimental data from HERA, H1 and SUS, and what you do is to essentially keep all the data which is at a very high energy. If you keep the data at very high energy, you are able to construct an effective lambda And you can see the Q-square dependence of your lambda. So again, when you are in this plot, when you are, and this is lambda, this is the power you have in your effective power in the cross-section, and Q-square is the distances you are resolving inside the hadron. So when Q-square is large, you are in a region, as you can see, which is of the order 0.3, and when it's small, Q-square is smaller, you are in the confinement region, it's of order 0.1, roughly speaking. It is possible, because I always get asked this question, if BFKL is seen in data. BFKL is such a fine-tuned limit of your amplitudes, okay, that it's very difficult to see that it dominates anywhere. However, you have this feature that it gives you a power like cross-sections. So you have to be... if you go to DIS, in DIS, for such a functions, or for cross-sections, you are summing over all final state. So there is contamination from lots of contributions that you didn't take in your original calculation. So you have to improve. In order to do phenomenology, first of all, you need BFKL at next to linear order, because you need scales for sure. Then you need to introduce collinear improvement of the BFKL equation. Plus, it turns out that you need also some optimal renormalization if you want to go to low Q-square. Optimal renormalization in the sense that you need to have some renormalization scheme which gives you some infrared fixed point. If you put all that, you get this kind of plot with with almost just two parameters in your feet. Okay? So it's possible to see the transition from half Pomeron to soft Pomeron. But there's a lot of discussion about this. Okay? Anyway, so this is, if you wish, all the picture of why we are doing this. Let me go a little bit into more the details of the... try to connect with you a little bit more. this affected vertex, I will tell you how to derive it a little bit later, but let me just indicate that we have... essentially, we have what is called a Rayleighized gluon propagator and some effective emission vertex. The square, when you put both things together, okay, the square of this vertex is essentially this piece here. These are all just two-dimensional transverse momenta. What I want to say is that it is possible to check that this vertex has a SL2C invariance. This SL2C invariance, originally by Lipatov, leaves, you have to manipulate this vertex a bit, which is you complexify the momenta. Okay, this transverse momenta you complexify, then you perform a Fourier transform, and then you realize that the structure will remain. You can think of it as a Hamiltonian, which this is is a Hamiltonian interaction between these two quantities. This Hamiltonian written in these coordinates has a holomorphic separability, so you have in the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic sectors, you have this SL2C invariance. There are easier ways to see SL2C here, which is directly performing a Fourier transform, and then you can see it there. Why all of this is connected to integrability at all is because this SL2C invariance, you can use some generators of the Moebius group to construct, if you want, lax connections. Okay? And then, but how all of this was realized and they map into a Heisenberg spin chain is because, of course, this result, although it's good for certain limits, it doesn't respect the unitarity in all channels because it doesn't respect the Fassard bound. We essentially had the unitarity in this channel, but you need also unitarity in other channels. One first attempt to introduce unitarity is to add many power-like contributions, and maybe summing them, the final result, the coefficients will have different signs, it will damp this growth. So a first attempt to do that is just to, okay, allow me to iterate. Let's see. Allow me to iterate. Before we had two of these lines, and now we iterate, and as we have a singlet exchange, this closes. So we have a periodic X Heisenberg X-Fit chain, and this was discovered by Lipatov and Fadev and Korchemsky. Okay? Now, I have until when? And half past? No.
No,
40. Okay. Yes. I'm trying to review 40 or 50 years of work, so okay. Okay, so this is where all the integrability appeared here, okay? Now, it turns out that It is the same type. This is what is called Bartel's Kwiecinski-Parlasowicz equations. Okay, it turns out that the same type of integral structure, which is a periodic spin chain, can be seen, has been seen recently in another context. Okay, and now we jump into something more formal. Let us try to calculate. I told you that all of this was valid for n equal 4 Supayan Mills. And if you are within the leading order approximation, both theories are the same. But of course it's possible to calculate also next to leading order. Let us focus on n equal 4 Supayan Mills, maximum helicity violating amplitudes, a planar limit, so the simplest thing you can imagine in terms of four-dimensional scattering. We tried to construct in 2008 the BFKL equation at the next to leading order, okay? In this limit. So we used what was available at the time. It was this Bernard-Dixon-Smirnov ansatz. So we thought that we could use it. If it was correct, it would be very easy to construct our kernel from it. Then we checked the analytic structure of this ansatz, and then we realized that in the kinematical regions, in multi-ray kinematics and quasi-multi-ray kinematics, the ansatz was not correct. Okay? We found that this ansatz was not correct from 6-point amplitudes and two loops. We were able to identify what was the missing piece in the ansatz, and we wrote it. There are some logarithms in terms of the Mandelstam invariance that you had in an amplitude. Okay? And it turns out that then it was later understood that indeed these are contributions to what is called the infrared finite remainder function of this amplitude. When you increase the number of legs in your amplitude, not only six, you go to higher number, it turns out that in the multi-ray limit, the structure of the amplitudes contains the same vertices I was talking before. But now, since these are color order amplitudes, the relevant representation is the adjoint representation in the T-channel, so these are open. You don't need to close it to have a singlet, so these are open spin chains. You can see in the middle, when you construct the amplitude, you need the solution to an open integrable spin chain. It's not exactly the same integrable spin chain as before, because being in the adjoint representation, we need to subtract, to factorize infrared divergences. But it's possible to subtract the infrared divergences, and you have a infrared finite remainder. And you can use the same integrability techniques to solve the amplitude. My review is going to finish almost here, okay? Almost with my talk. I want to indicate that there has been progress in putting together multi-ray kinematics and quasi multi-ray kinematics with symbology, with symbols, and in order to calculate up to high number of loops exact results. In that direction, the work of Dixon, Drummond, Durr, who's here, Henn, and Pennington, in my opinion, is the way to go forward. Otherwise, because when you use the traditional techniques for calculations a la BFKL, is much more complicated than what they are doing there. And second, I want to highlight recent results, understanding that you can calculate this scattering amplitude at the strong coupling by using some of these Y systems and this TVA ansatz. But it turns out that in multi-ray kinematics, everything simplifies a lot, and you might be able to solve the scattering amplitudes. So this ends my not-so-brief introduction. Now, let me go to... I will go quickly to this. It's a game I was playing with Alberto Romagnoni in Madrid. Let us eliminate all the complications in the BFKL equation. Okay. Let us do the following. I go to the forward limit. Okay. So I'm just really relating forward limit. There is zero momentum transfer. It's like you cut your emitted gluon, so it's 2 to n, the production of 2 to n. The amplitude with production of 2 plus n gluons. Then I was talking that we have the transverse momenta is in a two-dimensional space. So we will have, typically for the transverse momenta, we have a modulus and an azimuthal angle. Okay, this transverse momenta is living on a plane which is transverse to the two incoming external momenta. let me integrate out this azimuthal angle. Okay, the azimuthal angle is important because it's the Fourier conjugate of a conformal spin in terms of integrability before. But let me remove it. So I'm going to keep information only about anomalous dimensions. How to do this is just you do all of that, and then the equation you get is this one. Okay, this is the BFKL equation, and then it has two components. One, the first one, which is, let me just, is this part here, which is integrated over Q squared, and essentially it's telling me what is the probability of when I have one of these splittings to increase or to decrease the virtuality of my gluon. Okay, I can increase it or decrease it, the virtuality. And this is a piece which you can think about it as a point splitting regularization, but it corresponds to what is called the gluon trajectory. And it's not integrated over Q squared, and it tells me the probability that from this rapidity where this guy is emitted up to the rapidity where this guy is emitted, there is no production of any guy. Okay? This is the interpretation, the physical interpretation of this equation. Let me do something with it. Let me discretize in virtuality space. Okay? I just simply, the virtuality of these guys, I just write it in a discretized form, also in the integration, so I can write this sum as this sum. And again, for me the interpretation is the same one. This one here is gluon emission reducing the virtuality, gluon emission increasing the virtuality, and this is no emission, okay? So it doesn't change the virtuality of my gluons. And this is a harmonic number. A key feature is that the virtualities can have any value. They can go from zero up to infinity, okay? This equation. Now, there's a representation of the Hamiltonian for one loop anomalous dimensions of a spin S minus one of operators in the SL2 sector in N equal 4 super AR mills, written by Weiser long ago. And I'm just looking at it. It turns out that it's a representation which is the Hamiltonian acting on a double copy of a harmonic oscillator. And these powers in the harmonic in the creation operators correspond to excitations of a two-side one-dimensional lattice. Then this is very similar to the previous equation. Okay, it's essentially the same equation if we are able to collapse these two terms into one. That implies that we need to have the spin equal to 2n. Oh, I never see this. Sorry, S 2n minus 1. Okay, so if we act with that representation on a symmetric state, we are going to get this axion. We have bounded excitations because we can only go to 2n minus 1. And if I write in the same form the BFKL equation, I will have the same equation, but with unbounded virtualities. Okay. What is the relation between these two systems? Still looking into it, but I played some game. The following game. Let me take this. I'm going to use this Hamiltonian here with these bounded excitations as if it was the BFKL equation. I can write a vector, which is this vector with all the components, phi 1, phi up to n. N is the truncation in our matrix. Our Hamiltonian is written in this form. It has diagonal pieces and off-diagonal pieces. This would be evolution into increasing the virtualities, and this is evolution into decreasing the virtualities as we are emitting. Okay? And let me construct a BFKL-like equation for this system. And I'm going to construct this vector. The vector is exponentials of alpha y. Let me call this alpha is going to be minus lambda in the representation of Weiser. Y is a free parameter, which I know what it means in BFKL. Okay, and acting on some initial condition. The initial condition is not very important because I'm going to be looking at the asymptotic limit when alpha y is very large. And there is something nice when I look into the eigensystem of the matrix. I can always expand this initial condition on a basis of eigenstates of this matrix. And each eigenstate will have an eigenvalue. When I do that and look into the eigenvalue of this matrix, as I increase the size of the matrix, I get the following. You have a number of eigenvalues corresponding to the size of your matrix, as you can see. And as I increase the size, I see there is always a largest positive eigenvalue, which I gap with the next one, and then it goes into negative eigenvalues which start to accumulate. Okay? Since I am interested in alpha y being large, the dominant eigenvalue, therefore the dominant eigenstate, is going to be the one with this positive eigenvalue. Okay? Okay? So essentially, if I go to this limit, I can see that my system is going to evolve into this asymptotic state. It turns out that this is compatible with having a limit at the for log 2. I mean, this is compatible up to where I could calculate. I could calculate up to, 5,000, a matrix which is 5,000 times 5,000. Okay, but that's not important. I want to say that the asymptotic state is very much like a BFKL state because it has the same growth with energy. Not only that, let me look at the eigenstate of this largest eigenvalue. It turns out this eigenstate, the distribution in the components, you can see it here, is very much like the BFKL Green's function. There are normalizations and all that, but the trend is that the diffusion picture is a similar one. And also, let me say something else. The multiplicity picture is also a similar one. This is funny. I didn't expect this. It's possible to see the multiplicity. Essentially, when you are doing, for example, phenomenology with BFKL, you want to ask how many gluons you are emitting for a given energy. And the distribution of these gluons is a Poissonian-like. It's of this type. It broadens as you increase the energy, okay, and it peaks at some mean values. And the same picture you can get if you analyze properly this eigenstate. Now, all of this is only a game, but is this connected to some coherent state pictures of this SL2 spin chain? This is what we are trying to figure out. 10 more minutes. Now I will explain a little bit better how to calculate this emission vertex in QCD, but I will connect it to gravity. Okay. This is work with my student Eduardo Serna and Miguel Ángel Vázquez Mozo in Salamanca. If you want to learn anything about the Regi limit, you go to this paper, you understand everything. We repeat the calculation of the emission vertex. In order to eliminate U-channel diagrams, you take two distinguishable quarks, different flavor, and an emitted gluon. You have all these contributing diagrams. A nice trick is to split the diagram with the three gluon vertex into these two pieces, so you can construct two gauge invariant contributions. So your amplitude is the sum of two gauge invariant. This is exact. I didn't take any limit yet. Okay, so you can do this. But then, how to take the Regi limit? What do you do in the calculation, at least for the emission part? Allow me, the momentum transfer, let me call it here T and here T prime, Q1 square and Q2 square. Okay, these are four momenta. Then, allow me to do a Sudakov expansion of K1 with alpha times P. P is the momentum here, Q is the momentum here, beta 1 and some transverse component. And K2, it has alpha 2, beta 2, and some transverse component. Now, what is the leading order approximation, multi-ray kinematics? This ordering of rapidities is just to put a hierarchy in these variables. So K1 is going to be mainly P, and K2 is going to be mainly beta 2. If you do that, then you obtain an effective vertex with some couplings, which are not important. But this vertex, which corresponds to some off-cell gluon, off-cell, on-cell gluon, okay, this vertex is of this form. And this is the famous Lipatov vertex. When you square this vertex, is where you see all this Hamiltonian with SL2C invariance. It's only that, nothing else. Okay? Now, let me do the same thing in gravity. What is the simplest thing I can do in gravity to understand this? In gravity, I do a scalar-scalar, a distinguishable scalar, and I produce a graviton. I eliminate the U-channel diagrams, and the only extra feature is that I have this guy and this guy. The trick that we had before is still a nice trick, but more tricky. It is possible to play a little bit with the contribution. This is zero, and this gives you some two gauge invariant subamplitudes. This is exact, and this is Einstein-Hilbert, so it's complicated. We have to do it also through computer algebra. But this is going to help in the calculation of loop amplitudes by unitarity, because this reduces the topologies enormously, this gauge invariant subamplitudes. But now, let me take the Regi limit of this, and the Regi limit in the same way as before with QCD, exactly the same way, take your parameters and take limits, and then you realize all the following, is that the effective Regis graviton vertex is the square of two, it's not the bell, no? No, it's the electronic bell. Something is beeping there. So the vertex is going to be the square of two of the QCD effective vertices plus some correction. This correction, one can understand in terms of Regi theory because it's just to fulfill its time and relations. We are trying to understand if it is possible to really to make sense of this doubling in terms of the dual of these ideas of Dixon, Bern, Carrasco, and Johansson about the gravity to be the dual of a Gates theory. Maybe it's possible to make a good choice of polarization vectors in order to make this really an square. But I want to point out, is integrability present in gravity, okay, in this limit? I just want to tell you that doubling this vertex was integrable. It's still unclear if the square of this gravity vertices would also have some integrability. To start with, you lose some of this SL2C invariance, but maybe there will be other symmetries. So it's still work ongoing. I think if one is able to put it in the context of the work of Bern, maybe it's possible to see some integrability here, but it's only a dream, okay? So this is this part, and I think I have 5 more minutes. Yes, before the bell kills me. In Spain, when you hear these bells, it means a bull, so you have to run. okay. Anyway, so let's go for the bull now. So we have n sub gra, and what is the problem? Let us attack the following problem. I want to understand what is this business of graviton scattering. So it's 4-point amplitudes, graviton scattering, in the context of Rayleigh theory, because a few people from Russia talk about the Rayleigh gravitons and all that, so I wanted to understand what is really the meaning of all of this, and is it possible to calculate something which I understand. And so this is work with Johann Bartels in Hamburg and Leslie Patoff. And it appeared on Friday, okay. Let us just go to, you can go to the papers of, on exact amplitudes in the literature. And let us just do the following. I'm gonna, usually they are written in dimensional regularization. Let us trade this dimensional regularization for some mass regularization. Okay, this mass regularization for the infinite divergences is this lambda. So I'm doing nothing but that to write this expression. And this is exact amplitude, okay? So in any equal supergravity, 4-point amplitude at one loop, you get alpha is the Newton constant, essentially. T is the momentum transfer, and S is our S, and U is the U in 4-point amplitude. And there are only three pieces in this exact calculation. One piece is well known, and is the one everybody talks about, and it can be resummed, is the iconal contribution. Okay, this is an iconal contribution. I will show you that this is a pure phase when you take the Rayleigh limit. Now there is this piece which I'm going to call the graviton trajectory because it has a log of S, and this is what is, I didn't explain, but log of T over lambda squared is like a gluon Rayleigh trajectory. Let's say that this is the graviton trajectory here. Although there is no such a thing as a bootstrap equation in gravity yet. It's very complicated as compared to QCD. But anyway. And now there is another, it's very important, very important. This is infrared divergent. And there is a piece which is infrared finite, and it contains double logarithms. This is very important. And it's also important, this is alpha t, and this is alpha s. So the dominant contributions here, because they carry a power of s, more than the pieces upstairs, are the iconal ones. Okay, so when I'm talking about the graviton scattering, and I'm just resuming to all orders, iconal contributions, it's okay. We are talking about subleading pieces here. Okay? Now, let me take the Rayleigh limit. It's going to be the same amplitude, but I'm not doing much. Just U is minus S, because it's okay in the Rayleigh limit. So I get my double logs, my trajectory part, and the iconal. Fine. Now, the trajectory part and the iconal, we all understand because it exponentiates. All the infinite divergences in these amplitudes, in gravity amplitudes exponentiate. That's okay. I don't need to worry about it. However, the other piece is more tricky, okay? What happens with the other piece? So, question. Can we resum these double logs, okay, which appear here, to all orders in the gravitational coupling? This is the question. Let us try to do it. And in order to do it, let me factorize some of the pieces. I still keep this is technical. I still keep a little bit of this inside because I will use some effective vertices. But the main message is that I write all the information in this partial wave piece here. Okay. Now it is possible. There is experience on the calculation of double logs in QED and QCD. And to make a long story short, I can write an integral equation. I have a Born term. The contribution from the attached softest virtual gravitons in all possible topologies, plus a ladder contribution. Now it's inverted. This is S and this is T. And these are a pair of graviton or a pair of gravitinos. Okay? So the gravitational dependence comes into this piece here. Okay? Now, this equation, graphical equation, for this function f here, translates into this equation here. Okay? So you see n is the number of gravitinos. Okay? So this is the equation I need to solve. Now, a first approach is that I can solve it iterating. I iterate this equation. And if I iterate, you see, I can go at arbitrary order, but I get n minus 4 always in all the coefficients, okay? So something is happening for n equals 4. All these terms are going to cancel. But I have our information about the different supergravities. Let me, from this expression, I can make predictions. For example, I can make predictions for n equal 8 supergravity, okay, for these double locks. And my prediction will be that a loop, a one loop is this, a two loop is this, three loops, four loops, any number of loops. Now, I go to the literature. Okay, very interesting exercise, going to literature always. I go to the literature and there are results by Dunbar and Norwich long ago for the two loop, in n equal 8, two loop calculations from string theory. And they are in agreement with this. Also, works by Ben Carrasco Johansson using this idea of doubling gates in order to obtain gravity. But even more, we have a gravitational dependence. There was a calculation at the end of last year by Dixon and Boucher Begonneau, where they are very daring and say, okay, I'm going to do the doubling. No, the doubling consists of removing some numerators of n equal 4 superjamils, and you put two numerators. It's a doubling of n equal 4 superjamils, but you can reduce the supersymmetry of one of the n equals 4, and then you lower the number of supersymmetries in supergravity. So you can go to 4, 5, whatever. So they get results for that. And it turns out that our calculation is in agreement with that conjecture that they had. Yes. Pedro, wait for the discussion. You are very badly behaved. Otherwise, the belly is going to kill me. But the answer is yes, okay? So, now, not only, I mean, this is highly non-trivial, that we get the result for a number of gravitinos from this formula. If this formula is correct to all orders, this is very important, okay? We claim that it's correct to all orders. But it is possible to resum it, not only to give the expansion, but to resum it. We look at this equation very carefully with Russian eyes here. Okay. It turns out that you can write it as a Riccati equation, and this as a linear Schrödinger equation, which can be solved in terms of a parabolic cylinder function. You can do all that analytical, you can also do it numerically, but let's go to the point. The point is how the amplitudes behave as a center mass energy grows, keeping in mind all loop results and the full resummation of these guys. I'm going to factorize out the iconal and the regiais part. This is only the double locks, okay? But we already see something which still trying to understand, but I think is interesting. This is my last transparency. You see, n equals 4, we were getting all these n minus 4 coefficients, so in n equals 4, these double locks go away. So n equals 4 supergravity, for some reason, I don't know, all these guys go away. So it's flat, it's insensitive to all of this. And n equals 4 acts as if it would be a critical theory, so if you reduce the number of supersymmetries, your amplitudes go bananas, because they grow. This would be n equals 3, n equals 2, n equals 1, and n equals 0. No supergravity, no supersymmetry. We don't worry for the time being if it has been claimed that some of these theories are equal or not. Let me just take the Feynman diagrams, put gravitinos, and see what happens. So smaller than 4, this is not convergent. But as you increase the supersymmetry, it is convergent. This is for n equals 5, 6, they go to 0. But very nicely, 7 and 8 have this feature of having some oscillations. So they go down and they develop some oscillations that you can understand in terms of this Riccati equation. And they go to 0. So from this analysis, it's a full resummation to all orders. We see that n equals 7, n equals 8 are... let's say, better behave than Pedro theories, okay? And then I finish just saying that, in my opinion, it is worth looking into this limit more closely. I think it's very important, again, the work of Dur and collaborators in order to to try to put why theories get such simple results. It may be impossible to be understood in terms of symbols, or maybe with some elliptic surprises later on. But anyway, thanks for your attention.
So I just did not understand what part of the gravity result do you... So at one loop is the full result, there's nothing else. But at two loops, you reach some part of the result, but something remains, right? So how do you define what you compute? What's the definition of double log contribution at higher loops?
It's a log to the two.
Log to square. But you have, higher powers of logs. I was just seeing...
It's okay. What we are examining is this. I mean, of course, these amplitudes are very complicated, okay? Reduce the supersymmetries, they are less complicated. For any equality, they are very simple. And actually, they are so simple that you can write it in terms of symbols as essentially as an integral, where the integrand is just log to the cube over 3 plus something like I pi over half log square only.
And because it is iteration of a low loop result, that's why you don't see divergences, right? Because it, in practice, it's just a two loop result.
But also because these pieces don't contain divergences, because the double logs don't contain divergences. But so when you perform your calculation, you put as a natural cut, you don't need to put an infinite cutoff, you put as a cutoff some large momentum inside your diagram. So there's no, and this is very important because it goes beyond simple exponentiation. And that's why you get parabolic in the function, because it's not a simple exponentiation. Simple exponentiation are these guys here, because they contain the infinite divergence. This is not simple exponentiation. It's a deeper structure. If we are right, now it's a game of checking all these coefficients and all that, but in my opinion, this is a powerful result.
So what you're saying is that also that whether or not gravity or supergravity is finite doesn't really affect these results, or these results don't... Do they actually tell you anything? Because it's suspicious that, say, starting from n equals 4, you get this damping or boundedness. Does it say maybe that?
I would like them to say something, yes.
Okay.
However, one has to be cautious because indeed you are playing with one loop results. But the fact that it converges so well, in my opinion, is related to the finiteness of the theory. But this is still early days.
Just one by
At n equal 4, you just consider supergravity. At n equal 4, you can consider supergravity coupled to Young-Mills multiplets.
Yes.
Does this change your result, or you don't?
I mean, there's a camera, probably. I think, but I tell you why not. Because when you take this limit, eliminates information about many of the states in the theory.
So you don't. So what is really important that you have four gravitinos nothing else is important.
Exactly. If you go to the previous part of my talk, I was considering external states. It could be quarks or it could be scalars. You remove all that, it's going to come as what is called impact factors. That they are process dependent, but the universal feature is what is inside in these effective vertices.
So that basically means that this really doesn't tell anything about UV finiteness or softness, because you can easily change that by adding...
Yes, yes. If you start to tamper with the theories, these results can change. But the calculations are it's not so easy to get this integral equation that we wrote. So.
Can I ask in the meantime? I have just a conceptual question, I think continuation of Pedro's first question. So, I mean, in general, this limits this Regi limit, right? You take, say, a scattering of two particles, T is fixed, S is very big, right? So you have a power-like dependence on S, right, in this limit. So on the other hand, the total cross-section from unitarity, right, should not grow as a power. So on the other hand, if you take the t equals zero part of the two particle scattering, you're supposed to get the, and the imaginary part of that, you're supposed to get the total cross-section. So how is it reconciled? I mean, this, the imaginary part is zero or, I remember Lipatov discusses some unitarity problems in that approximation, right?
As I said, you have S-channel unitarity, T-channel unitarity is more difficult to fulfill, unitarity in all channels. And then you have to take into account, you see, in order to use these results, for example, for phenomenology, you are in a window. Where it's a power-like, but you are not sensitive to these unitarization effects. This is for phenomenology. Okay, that's why I am able to get this plot of the hard pomeran to soft pomeran. One. But you are right, this is not the full story, by no means. There are transition vertices which are not considered. For example, just a second. Everybody talks about this integrability here, this guy, and it's a possible way of unitarization. It's not enough, it's only a model of unitarization. In order to get proper unitarization, you have to make transitions from this guy to two of these guys. It's what is called this pomeran to two pomeran vertices. That is, you are starting to have T-channel unitarity, and then you start losing this power-like behavior. And the simplest way to see it is that your equation are nonlinear and becomes your growth starts stopping and it starts bending when you look into your immediately when you impose this nonlinearity. So you are absolutely right. It is difficult to foresee in this context is those vertices. One can prove that the leading log approximation they are SL2C invariant as well. So one can foresee that one can construct a two-dimensional field theory where everything is SL2C invariant, and the integrability will be realized in a different way based on this. But the whole problem is very complicated. Lipatov he's been working with an effective action for several years in order to develop this theory. I have some papers proving that how to use this effective action to loop calculations that things we already know is very difficult, but we are getting, at least I'm learning some tricks how to use it. The hope is that to solve that problem is to, it is, it, if you want to read about that, I have a paper with Álvarez Gaumet and collaborators on how to attack that problem from the gravity side. It's a little bit crazy paper, but it's fun to read. But it's a very complicated problem. Thanks for the question.
Okay, so before the audience turns into a herd of hungry cows, maybe let's thank Augustine again. Thank you.